RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday, March 26th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Well, we talk all things football all year round. We are about a month away from the NFL draft. We have a lot to talk about. We're going to focus a little bit today with the NFL owners meetings. Going to tell you a little bit about how the process works, what goes on. Thought you might be interested in that, take you inside the walls of what goes on in that environment, how things are discussed in some of the committees and so on and so forth. Talk a little bit about kind of what's on the table today and kind of revisit some of the issues with regard to how they will figure out things going forward with replay and rules and judgments and overturns and things like that that obviously, quite frankly, overtook in large part the end of the regular season in a very controversial way. So we'll get into that. Folks, a lot going on at LandryFootball.com. I say it every time. I'll say it again. If you haven't joined us, we've got over a 50% discount on our scouting season sale. It's no better place, no better time to be at LandryFootball.com, where we take you step by step through the free agent process. We know the big names have gone, but a lot of big names still out there. We've got you covered with all the information, what's going on there in our notebooks, what's going on here at the owners' meetings, and what is taking place with visits and whatnot. Obviously, the way the league works right now is there's more focus on the draft. You'll see a revisit, a trickling of information in terms of free agency. And you'll see a bigger jump with free agent information after the draft is over. As I've explained before, the process is go out, target some free agents that you really like, settle down a little bit, focus on the draft, get that done. You can't figure out your needs in one of the first two spots. Then you go back to free agency and see if you can't find some bargains. So we've got you covered through that. Draft boards. Hope you've been following it. We've got our draft boards up. We're working it through. Going to finish up our defense this week. All the offensive positions. Here's how it works. We give you an evaluation criteria for that position. The average physical traits for that player. The critical factors of each position. What difference does it make if you get some goofy list? If you don't explain how the list is determined, how players are graded, we got that for you. Then we give you a draft board that is a true draft board, drafted by grades, not just telling you who are the first, second, third, fourth, but, for example, if you're looking at the centers, are there any 7.4 to 7.0 grades? Are there any 6.9 to 6.5 grades? How many 6.4 to 6.0 potential starter grades? And then there's 6.4s. 6.0s, what's the difference? Where's the cutoff point? So how many players are potential starters? How many players have a chance to make it? How many guys are potential backups and contributors, roster players? Give you the numbers, give you who they are, give you where the separation is. Who's worthy of bringing into a camp? We give you all of that information. But we bring it to you how it looks in a real draft room. That's what we do. Having one draft for years, that we try to do. So we've got all the draft stuff as well as what's going on with pro days, what's going on with visits, with teams. Got all that information in our daily draft notebooks. For you college fans, got our college football notebook every day. Updated, what's going on? Any transfer news? We've got spring practice notes. Got recruiting notes. We've got it all for you. All this for less than a magazine subscription with this special scouting season sale. Take advantage of it. And of course, you want to catch this podcast every Tuesday and Thursday. And you want to catch our Rush the Field podcast every Wednesday, which is a college football podcast only. And don't forget to get the free War Room newsletter every week by signing up on LandryFootball.com. All you need to do is provide your email. Go to LandryFootball.com, about halfway down the right, not even halfway down, just a little bit under the scouting season sale logo. We've got the War Room logo. Click on that. Get the latest news and film room breakdowns in your box. Click on that. Subscribe to the War Room. Put your email in. Subscribe, and you'll get that free. So an opportunity to get some information that is not been something that's been you won't see published in other areas, but gives you some really good information about scouting, about coaching, about what's going on news related. So all you got to do is follow those instructions. Got some good questions we're going to get into today. Question about the Clemson situation. Question about Eli Manning. A couple of questions and observations from I'll Rush the Field podcast talking about the history of LSU football. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk a little bit. We've got a good question about where things are with regard to college football and scandals and off the field situations, paying players, which is kind of understood, wink, wink, but some information that why it's not as prevalent today. We'll get into all of that. The coaches have unilaterally agreed. Pardon me, and voted, or excuse me, have amongst themselves voted that they would all like to see an eighth official in the booth to oversee and overturn calls on the field in egregious situations. Like, for example, in the conference championship games, Kansas City is called for a roughing the passer penalty on Tom Brady, clear on the replay. Didn't even touch him. The official was, well, not a position. He was just in a position where it looked like he might have been hit, but he wasn't hit, and he missed it. Could have easily been overturned. Critical play in the game. And, of course, we all know the most critical play, maybe, and most egregiously bad call ever, was the Saints against the Rams. The non-call. So the coaches want that changed. But it's sounding more and more like it will not get approved. I think that my experience is there's always a fear of taking that leap forward by owners. And we'll get into the makeup of the competition committee and how this process works in a second. But there's always that fear that when you take that step and take that leap, there's unintended consequences that come about. And that certainly is true. You have to think those through. In fact, there is a little bit of group of people, been involved with it myself, where you sit there and look at a rule and say, okay, if we do this, what might this do for something else? And will this create some consequences negatively that could be a problem? You always look at that. You always study that. The ownership group making changes is very, very slow. They're concerned to do it. There's a concern to overturn a no call in that, okay, if you don't have a call, you have a no call, and you go back and you look at it, and this is a valid point, even though I am certainly someone that is in favor of that eighth guy in the box. If you go back and let's say you replay a call, and on the replay you see that, but you also see a holding that you miss, where does it go? Do you ignore one thing and pay attention to the other? Do you adjust everything on that play? Do you just focus on one thing? Is it going to be strictly instituted upstairs? And again, if they notice a second thing, that becomes part of the issue. Now, you know by now my feeling on it. We're never going to get perfection in officiating calls. It's not what it's about. Here's the problem, or here's the issue that must be addressed. And it will be addressed at some point. Unfortunately, because it can be a little archaic, it's going to come later than sooner. There's going to have to be more problems. As I like to say, we're going to have somebody else get hit at the four-way before we put up a stop sign or a red light. My belief is that there should be an official in the booth with a couple of assistants with the ability to rewind every play and to notify in real time the head official on the field that of something. You know, I mean, constant communication. Hey, there's a good call there. You got that right. Yeah. Hey, watch it. It looks like you might be, you know, holding's getting a little close there. You're kind of missing some things. Constant communication, constant feedback. Why wouldn't you have that ability to coach and assist your officiating crew just like you do to coaches with your players? You should have that. The head guy and the top guy should be in the booth. He should oversee that. He should be able to call down and educate and help. And if there's an egregious issue that he feels needs to be called, then he does it. If he sees holding and he sees an interference call, you know, he goes ahead and he says, look, we miss a holding and we miss an interference. Then, you know, then we have that's your answer. That's your answer right there. Correct anything that's correctable that you feel is egregious and is missed. If you look at it and it's clear that one is called or not called, the other one's maybe a little ambiguous, then you don't overchange something because you think it's 55% that it's one way. No, you do something that's clearly egregious. The problem that you have is that if the whole world can see that it's wrong and you do nothing, you lose credibility as a league, as an entity. And until they figure that out, yes, we know there could be issues. We know that other things could come up. And I don't think it should be limited to just everything. I think there's ways that you can do it. I do not believe in coaches' challenges. I don't think it's fair to put a coach in that situation of doing the official's job. That should be challenged by the crew to get it right. It's their job. In the current world, we have the coach's challenge. I don't like the, hey, we got to throw the red flag in this. I think it's fine for an official to question and wonder why, but isn't it up to the official to do their job correctly? I've never liked that. But since we are in that world, you know, having a coach that can challenge anything, don't give them an extra challenge. Let them challenge everything. That's the Bill Belichick rule. And I know it may seem like I don't agree with everything Bill does or says, but this is one that makes some sense. That way, you're not going to challenge any nitpicky stuff. You're going to save your challenges for the end of the game in case something happens egregious. Well, I think you need to look at that is a possibility as well, to where, you know, Sean Payton could have challenged. But what if, and here's my argument against that, what if Sean Payton didn't have any challenges left? Well, are you going to criticize him for using his challenges? What if you got an officiated game that sucks and you got to challenge an egregious error early? And then you're criticized because you don't have enough challenges at the end. Who's going to think that this is going to be this bad? You're going to have to just keep a challenge in your pocket every game in case that it's at the end and there's the worst call. And then maybe you have to walk away with it in your pocket that you could have challenged it early. It's putting unnecessary responsibility on the coach that shouldn't belong on him. This should be done by the officiating crew. It should. If somebody notices that it's wrong, boom. And we need to get out of this. And this is where the problem is with the league and their officials. The officials feel targeted. They feel like they're getting singled out and they're getting hammered. It is not an affront on officials. Players make mistakes. There are means to correct it. Coaches make mistakes. There means to correct it. Officials are going to make mistakes. They're human. The players are bigger, stronger. They're faster. It's tough to see things. This is why you need the technological help to get the calls right in a timely fashion. Okay? College football, we have a major problem. The games go too fast. Games go too long because there's a lot of reasons for it. Stop the clock after first down, so on and so forth. A lot of changes need to be there. But in the NFL, we can't have games constantly, you know, stopping the game and looking at replays. The game needs to be looked at in real time, replayed, and then, and if there's anything that's egregious, there comes a situation where the crew can ask to review it. And you know what? Maybe they're a little bit more cautious towards the end to make sure that they get it right so they don't have egg on their face. What's wrong with that? There's everything right with that. That's the thing that I think the league is missing out on. All right, let me talk a little bit about, you know, for a to implement a new rule or procedure, you got to have 24 votes out of 32. So they've, you know, you've got to have, it's like any voting in a Congress or votes to block and whatnot. So a couple of things to keep in mind. The owners' meetings always get started technically on a Sunday night. There's kind of a welcome. There's a social gathering. There is a speaker. There's an introductory note about the week coming up on a Sunday night. Monday morning, the owners get together, and they normally handle some statutory bylaws, things that, that you most fans would not even be interested in, but they're just procedural issues that need to be focused on. There is a booklet provided for them of what is the agenda, the topics. At that time, they will address those issues. They will also be given by the competition committee a report, which can be anywhere from 250 to 450 pages of a binder of a booklet that is given to them that goes through every situation, any proposed rule changes. You, by the way, a club can propose a rule change. The league office, although they rarely do it, can propose a rule change. The competition committee can propose a rule change. And this is explained and presented to all the clubs on Monday. The competition committee usually has three coaches on it. By the way, it's rotated. The coaches are rotated. There's actually a subcommittee. Coaches actually go on a subcommittee, kind of like the JV of the competition committee for coaches, if you will. And they're on that, serve on that for a while and become really involved in some of the procedure issues within the league and as it relates to the competition on the field. And once they get enough experience, they're rotated on to the competition committee, and the, you know, the other guys rotated off, and that's kind of how that works. There's usually, you know, a couple of general managers on it, and there's usually two, three owners, and then there's the chairman, which is Rich McKay. Now, the competition committee meets in Indianapolis at the combine. They'll meet 6 days, and they'll go over all the files of the year, all the proposals, all the issues, and then they'll meet again, the competition committee will, 1 week prior to the owners' meeting. So they've been meeting for a week. They'll have a good 14, 15 days under their belt of meeting, long days of going over everything, film, and then there's a booklet to where they put together these proposals and ideas to go over in detail everything that they need to go over. There's a lot of lobbying, and you know, there are people on the committee, but they're obviously they're talking to all the coaches. They're talking to front office personnel, football people. And so they have an idea of what the thoughts are. So I think they're very representative of things that need to be looked at and how people view it. There's lots of lobbying, as you might can imagine. It is, again, very much like Congress. There's tweaking of it. For example, you know, you feel like you're not going to have enough votes. What is it that you don't like? Well, I'm fundamentally okay with this, but I don't like that. And if you tweaked it this way, then, you know, we could get it going. So you have a lot of compromises. And so they'll go back, the competition committee will, and they will rewrite and tweak it to where they could get it passed. Because if they can't get everything, they'll get at least something. What they'll normally do is they'll meet on things on Tuesday, and they'll get the kind of the what I call the rubber stamp agendas there, the smaller things that everyone's in agreement on. They'll get that out of the way. They'll save the biggest issue, or you might consider the most controversial, the big ticket item, for last. And look, they'll look at it and they'll save that for to Wednesday before they head back. So on Wednesday, what you're going to have is perhaps a vote on a certain issue. Sometimes, because they don't feel they have the votes, they'll table it to the May meetings, which are the week before Memorial Day. And so normally when that's done, it's just because there needs to be more tweaking and more studying because they know it's not going to work. So they'll either vote on it, move on, or they'll say, let's table it to May. And then the people that are involved are going to have to spend time on it to tweak it and adjust it to make it more more presentable, more votable, if you will, in May. So you've got, again, a good representation. The director of officials is there. There's attorneys involved that are involved with like any CBA issues to make sure that, well, this legally can be done. It can't be done. So it's a very involved process. The one thing that is a little bit tricky is, first of all, the owners will vote on it. They usually go in line with what their coach thinks, but just depends on the organization and the amount of stroke the head coach has. It can get often, heated, just contentious on certain things. Not everybody in the organization agrees on the same rules and agendas. And it's up to the owner to kind of fight for his coach to do things that are going to benefit him. Some do it better than others. I have seen this happen a lot. On Tuesday afternoon, it's the coaches' golf outing. And I've seen votes taking place by the owners, and the coaches are out playing golf, and all of a sudden there's something that was voted in. It's kind of backdoored. Those are never really good situations. So it's an interesting process. It's one in which there are several things that are taking place with owners gathering that's just owners and just get together, discussions. But then obviously there's a lot of people that are there as experts in a certain field, in a certain area that's pertaining to one part of a rule or one part of an issue pertaining to the league. They'll listen to that. So I wanted to give you that idea, give you that overview of how it works, because a lot of people are frustrated by maybe the lack of decisions that are made, and rightly so. Certainly fair to question that. But it is not done haphazardly. It is done with a process. It's done with a great deal of thought. And when they don't approve something that is, to us, pretty obvious that's the right thing to do, it's not because they don't care. It's because they feel it's going to bring about some unintended consequence that could maybe open the Pandora's box, so to speak. And that's why. And I think they've got to get through that. And I do think there's just a tendency, as I said, to kind of hold on to the way things are. It took forever to even get to replay. Some people are frustrated with replay because you can't get it right with replay and it slows the game. The answer is not to go back and have all sorts of – the answer is to go forward with technology to make it smoother, to make it quicker, to make it more efficient, and to get it right. Again, as long as TV is going to have replay for us to watch, you're never going to be in the clear with replay. You're always going to have to deal with that because we're going to have replay for us to see. And if everybody else can see it but you can't use it, it'll be foolish. It will be absolutely foolish. We've got to figure out a way, and it just takes some time and patience, which we all sometimes get frustrated with. Okay, thought it was worth you understanding a better understanding of. I've seen some things happen in owners' meetings that was some real humdingers. I mean, from, you know, one of it was, you know, Tom Benson basically crying and you know, wanting to move the team from New Orleans to San Antonio after Katrina, and Paul Tagliabue and the other owners saying, no, we're not going to leave a city that's just been drowned out. I mean, I've seen issues with, you know, Art Modell and Al Davis and, you know, some really at the Raiders traditionally abstained their vote. They didn't vote on any issues. So when you had a vote on whatever, you know, it's always 31 yeas, no noes, one abstention. It's the Raiders. Just the way of the Raiders, just kind of thumbing the nose at the establishment, as Al always thought he should have been the commissioner of the NFL when the leagues merged. But anyway, all right, I'm going to finish off with some questions. Morgan asks, what happened to the Clemson PED investigation? Did Clemson mistakenly provide PEDs to players all season? Are they required to inform the NCAA if players fail random tests during the year? They are not required, but there's testings that are done, because if you're testing positive by the school, you know that you're in danger of getting tested positive by the NCAA, and that becomes an issue. There will be an investigation. I don't know what's going to come of it. I don't know what Clemson did or didn't do. They've denied certain things. They've admitted to certain things. So I wish I had the definitive answer. I don't think anybody does right now. Peyton asks about Eli Manning. Why are the Giants holding on to Eli? Well, because Peyton, they think he can still play. And they think with a better team around him, he can still be very good with them. Now, it doesn't mean they also, if they're going to draft a quarterback, and I don't know if they are inclined to do so. I mean, they are inclined to do so if they like one of these guys. If they have a good grade on Dwayne Haskins, absolutely. They want to draft a quarterback with Eli there so that they can sit him and groom him. That's what they would like to do. So that's the reason. They believe that Eli can still play. They believe the problems are that they don't have enough protection. They don't have enough weapons. They're not playing well enough on defense. They're trying to do their best to move the pieces around Eli to give them a chance to be competitive while also drafting his replacement behind him. And that's what they're doing. I mean, it's pretty clear what they're doing. I don't know that why that's so difficult. If you get rid of Eli, then what do you do? They got nothing. You know, you got to replace talent with talent. And while Eli is not the same quarterback as he has been, he's better than anybody they got, and they need to find someone better. And the time to do it is while he's still there and groom him. And if they didn't think he could play, he wouldn't be on the team. Larry asks, or nice comment. Appreciate that. he was asking, is there any reason why we aren't seeing college football programs under investigation anymore? I find it hard to believe that everyone is behaving these days. Well, Larry, a couple of things. The investigative arm of the NCAA is just powerless. What's happened with the NCAA, and it could be traced a little bit to the Penn State Sandusky situation, the Miami situation, where they were basically couldn't prove it, and basically the school lawyered up and sued them, and the NCAA realized that they don't have the enforcement arm to investigate a lot of this. They rely on media reports about, you know, this happened and that happened. You know, if you look at it, and because it's this time of year, the LSU and the Arizona basketball situation, you know, where, you know, I think it was Yahoo Sports uncovered some stuff. If they hadn't covered it, no one would know about it. The NCAA is not out following every nook and cranny, and they don't have the resources to do that. They just take apart what the media says. They follow up on it. They investigate. And what they do is they threaten that if you don't cooperate as a university, you're going to be hit harder. And although they've been very inconsistent with that, North Carolina did not cooperate with their whole academic fraud scandal. And Missouri did cooperate. Missouri was still hammered. North Carolina lawyered up and beat it. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of mixed signals. So here's the thing. The reason why you don't have it is the investigative arms are significantly less than they used to be. I think that there's still things that are going on, of course. It's done differently than it used to. In this day and age, with everybody having a camera with a cell phone, then, you know, cell phone and the camera on it, it's you're always in danger of getting caught. But to prove it is another issue. I think that there are things that are definitely getting done. I don't think overall it's as bad as it used to be, but I would say that it's different. I think that in college basketball with all these AAU handlers, I think it's caused more of an issue. We've had more of that being a deal. It's been more about, you know, those shoe companies, you know, pushing kids to a certain place. There's more of that in basketball. Football is a game of numbers, and it happens, but it happens a little more subtly. It happens a little bit more out of the limelight. And so, yeah, things happen, but that's the reason why. There are things that are being done, and then I think that there's a lot of things that can't be proven. I mean, let's go into the Cam Newton situation. Mike Slive, who was a commissioner of the SEC, former NCAA member of the NCAA enforcement and legal team, he got that to go away real quickly. So anybody think that Cam Newton turned down money from Mississippi State to go play to Auburn for free? Of course not. You've had other issues. You know, LSU had a situation along with a few others, Oregon, or the two, but there were others that were paying a handler through a, I don't know, a fee of money. They used it as a cover of, they were paying for film of high school players in Texas. Well, what they were really doing is they were spending money for the handler to kind of steer certain high school players who he had relationships with seven on sevens and all that, to steer them to their school. Couldn't prove it. I mean, now, it was pretty obvious. The one guy, he was asked to provide the tapes of players, and he couldn't even come up with it. He had to come up with a list that was like 2 years old. I mean, so it's pretty obvious that he was getting paid, you know, cash to deliver players, but it never got to the point where they could prove it due to the lack of enforcement. I think just what's happened is in some of these cases, in basketball, it's come down to where the FBI is involved. Well, when the FBI is involved, you know, they have the resources, they have subpoena power, they can do anything. And then if they get you with the NCAA, can just come in and just, you know, read what's going on and say, you're hammered, we got you. But the NCAA doesn't have subpoena power. They don't have the ability to do all that. Therefore, guys walk away, or guys get away with it. What has happened, I think, more on the basketball side is it's gotten into more of where the FBI is involved, because it's involved a lot of these shoe deals and dealers, and that's contributed to it. All right. A good friend and listener, Rock, said, nice comment. I love your Rush the Field comments on LSU. I have a lot of indirect ties to the program. I watched Bob Devaney's Nebraska team win their first ever national title over Charlie McClendon's 1970 LSU team in the Orange Bowl. I remember that as well, very closely. Thus, I've always wanted to know more about McClendon. Coach Mack was a great guy. Coach Mack, when you was really good with his players, worked hard, good hold of his team, very good coach. Was there a long time, dealt with a lot of the politics that exist at LSU and handled it very well. Didn't beat Alabama enough. I mentioned he had a 69 team the year before this one. Had a really good team. Might have been national championship caliber. Kind of got the short end of the stick. Notre Dame started to go to the bowl games. But it's a really good coach. Really good guy. You know, just a salt of the earth type of guy, and was very, very popular among his coaches. He was the head of the College Football, you know, Coaches Association. for years and years. National Football Foundation, Coaches Association, what have you. He also mentioned Bill Lawrenceberger, one of my mentors, ruined the Christmas with Miami defense. Really good team. He talks a little bit about Johnny Robinson. Yeah, Johnny Robinson was a great one, great guy as well. Johnny was a great player and a great Chief. Rock is a Chief fan. And if you remember that 71 Christmas Day game, was the longest game ever, double overtime, and the great Ed Podolak day there, and the Gary Premium ending the game. Rock says, I'll never forget the 1988 earthquake game win over Auburn. Neither will I, Rock. I was on the field coaching at that time, so I will always be amongst my favorites there. And finally, he's got a question about LSU quarterback Tommy Hodson. He was unfortunately drafted by a Patriots organization that was among the very worst in the NFL at the time. Could a guru quarterback such as Bill Walsh have made Hodson into a good pro quarterback, or was Hodson record was? He was what he was. Tommy was very bright. He was very tough. He was very limited physically. Could Bill Walsh made him better than he was? Absolutely. But he was not a starting caliber quarterback in the league. He just didn't have enough physical qualities. And I love Tommy. See him often, play golf with him, good friend, and was the first player that I ever recruited to LSU. Tommy was only offered a couple of scholarships, by the way. He was not offered. I found him, and he was going to go to one of the directional schools in Louisiana. He, you know, Tulane was interested, Louisiana Monroe, Northwestern State, Natchitoches. He wasn't offered by any other SEC schools, and I thought he could play, and we offered him late, and that's that. Rock also asks about Billy Cannon, and Billy Cannon being a dentist, and he was actually Lynn Dawson's dentist, which that is something I did not know. I knew he was a dentist. I didn't know it makes sense, but I didn't know that he was Lynn Dawson's dentist. But he became a dentist, an orthodontist, and Billy Cannon was a legend. He grew up in Baton Rouge, went to Broadmoor High School. He's one of the greats. Jim Taylor was as well. A lot of the great Louisiana players, if you go down in history, you know, a lot of them come from all corners of the state of Louisiana. You've had a few of them in Baton Rouge, quite a few that, but not many of them. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just kind of the way it is. Billy was one of the local legends of Baton Rouge, and he's the only Heisman Trophy winner at LSU. I did mention Billy got into some trouble, was involved, and I don't remember all the details or how or what have you, but he was involved in a counterfeit money scheme, and the feds came to his house, and they found ice chest stuff full of counterfeit money in the backyard. I don't mean to laugh. And he went off to jail. In fact, he had to pawn off his Heisman Trophy to a local restaurateur in Baton Rouge that kind of put it in his, you know, store window and whatnot. So Billy had some hard times, but he was kind of welcomed back into the LSU community. So he's, look, I mean, he had the greatest career, you know, and he fall from grace and came back, and he was somebody that was respected and liked. It was close to the LSU program and followed it and supported it till we lost him fairly recently. I have another, you know, little element to it, just to give you an idea how things were done at the time. When he came out, he was of college. Billy Cannon, a guy that I worked for, Bud Adams, was the owner of the Houston Oilers of the AFL. They literally signed him, and this is how things were done back then. I think it's kind of quaint, and it was the old Wild Wild West-ish type, but literally, when Billy Cannon played his last college game, leaning against the goalpost, Bud Adams has a contract for him, and he signs with the AFL. It was that competitive where literally You had to be the first one there. There are old stories of like that, and that signing a guy on the field, or, you know, holding a guy out in a hotel room under an assumed name, so no one else could get a hold of him. Just some interesting, you know, stories have taken place over time. But so Billy Cannon was, yes, he was a great player. Played with the Oilers, played with the Raiders as well. So it was interesting, an interesting life, an interesting career. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. By the way, on Rush the Field podcast this week, the program that we will talk about is Notre Dame. We're going to go down through the history. Obviously, no one has a longer story tradition and the most unique tradition than Notre Dame, so we'll get into that. We'll be back on Thursday for another edition of the Landry Football Podcast. More fallout from the owners' meetings, more draft preparation, you name it. We've got it all for you. Reminder, if you haven't yet joined LandryFootball.com, check it out today. Get our scouting savings special. Spread the word, will you? Do us a favor and spread the word about this podcast, about the Rush the Field podcast, all the things we're doing here. Really would appreciate your help in growing our family here. And if we can help your business in any way, contact us here at LandryFootball.com. We will help you do that as well. Talk to you on Thursday, everybody.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is an MMA Insider's Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Is this like the third time Conor's quote-unquote retired?
Yeah.
I mean, like to me, like, I'm sorry, this is a negotiation tactic. Let's not kid ourselves. This is what this is. I mean, like, if you are running ESPN right now, you wake up to this news, you're going, what the hell? You know the phone call is going to Dana White, going to Ari Emanuel, going, we just spent all this money with you over the last 6 months, and your biggest draw is not fighting anymore? Please tell me what's going on.
You know, I'm wondering, though, if we see all the stuff going on with Connor, and we hear all the rumors, and then you hear the reports about him in Florida smashing a fan's cell phone. It really raises the question, is there things going on outside of Connor's life right now that would prevent him from getting into the cage sooner rather than later? The speculation was that he would maybe fight this summer. Are there things happening that would prevent that from taking place? Is this announced retirement something more out of convenience? Is it a cover story for something bigger? You know, the report was also out there that he was offered an opportunity to fight Donald Cerrone, and it was going to be the co-main event, and he didn't want any part of that, which I can completely understand. That to me is ridiculous that Dana White would even offer that to him. You know, the biggest draw in the sport right now, and you want him to co-main event. Who cares whether or not he has a title? That's just insane to me.
The MMA Insiders can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.